Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Oh, I say, it's amazing.
He does it tame and tame and tame again.
Break up the music, charge your glass. This nation is going to dance all night.
The hapless but unifying body language of a player who suddenly becomes the only one who doesn't know where the ball is. The oldest rationale in the book for a player skying a shot over the bar. The not quite synced up stadium clock when watching on TV. A genuinely worrying peripheral AstroTurf hang-up. Are we being cheated out of some midweek mystique when two clubs from the same country are drawn together in European competition? And the impact of the iPad on managerial decorum after their team has conceded a very specific type of goal. Brought to your ears by Goal Hanger Podcast. This is Football Clichés and your Mesut Haaland Dix. Hello everyone, welcome to Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me to hear this month's listeners' footballing fascinations and irritations for Mesut Haaland Dix is Charlie Eccleshare. Hello.
Hello.
And David Walker. Hello.
Hello.
Very esoteric selection this month, Charlie. Are they getting weirder, do you think, the choices?
I don't know. I feel like they're getting more and more in like we're sort of becoming one brain. A lot of these now are becoming so firmly in our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
As I think us and our listeners become increasingly in sync with one another. I wanted to throw one in actually. Mm. No, this isn't, I don't particularly love or hate this, but more just a football language thing that happened to me in the wild. I was playing football the other week. In my preferred kind of advanced central midfield role. And not one, but two of the youngsters who play in this team, which already makes me feel extremely old, said to me, "You're playing Cam, yeah?"
Cam.
Yeah. You're playing Cam, yeah? And it really took me a moment to be like, what are you talking about? And they meant CAM, the kind of popular...
FIFA speak.
Yeah, FIFA.
CAM would be borderline for me, but Cam can't have that. Yeah. That's like VAR.
Not one,
like
but two. Two of them asked me if I checked that I was playing Cam. And it really did take me a moment to be like, oh, yeah, absolutely, yep. Yeah.
Playing Cam. You say tip of the diamond in my day.
Yeah, exactly.
Which does sound better. So it is inarguable. Oh, well, good to see you still going in the FIFA era. Right, okay, so as I said, Dave, we've got some strange selections here, which it's a shame. It's a shame for those who are still hung up on, I don't know, team sheets being tweeted out in a strange order and stuff like that. They're not going to make the cut anymore.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the listeners' MHD are getting more weird, more niche, and I'm here for it. It's great. Because the celebrity MHDs are on the other end of the scale. And they take care of the more mainstream, their kind of loves and hates, and the listeners really have taken the Irritation and Fascinations remit to heart. So I think it's a nice contrast.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, they do. Yeah, they dovetail quite nicely. But they're not weird for weirdness's sake. Like, these are all meeting a particular bar of sort of subconscious triggering, I think. So I'm really happy with this month's selection of six. Let's kick off with the listeners' fascinations for April. First one comes from Tom Atkins.
I'm a big fan of when the ball ricochets up in the air and a player does a full 360-degree turn looking for the ball before it lands behind him. It's one of those rare, relatable moments where the game played on Sunday mornings all over the country at least bears some resemblance to the game that we'll pay to watch on a Saturday afternoon. For the briefest of split seconds, we know something that the highly trained elite player doesn't. And for me, it's a wonderful moment.
We always enjoy these, Charlie, these kind of gap bridging moments between amateur and professional footballers where they look hapless and we sort of revel in it a bit. That is a sort of a tangible thrill for a lot of people, I imagine.
Yeah, and it also, like, this is, it's a kind of fascination for me in a slightly different way, is when that does happen in Sunday League, there's this thing where you're so desperately trying to communicate to the player where the ball is, and you know there's no way you can ever communicate it to them, and they're not going to do exactly as he's describing here, of just being confused and not really knowing where the ball is. And you're like, just listen to me. I'm telling you, if you absorb this information, we're in such a good position. You just know it's impossible, but you can't help try. And you're like, oh, one day this will be possible.
The body language of a player searching for the ball in their kind of peripheral vision or outside of it, Dave, is a very, very established, doddery kind of thing, isn't it? It is as hapless as it sounds.
Yeah, it's such a disorientating thing when it happens to you. And you're right, Charlie, like when you can see it, it's so, you know, you'll always say, it's there, look, yeah. Wait. But when you're the person who's it's happened to, you just literally have no idea where it is. And it's like annoyed. You get annoyed at the other people. I can't see it. You know what's happened here. I don't have eyes in the back of my head. I cannot see the ball. I'm not just leaving it. I'm not just walking away thinking the job's done.
It's a real pure ignorance, Charlie. Like, it's total ignorance of where that ball is. Like, it could be anywhere. Height, distance. It's I wouldn't say it's blissful ignorance. It's the most unnerving thing that could happen to you on a football pitch, I think.
Yeah, no, it really is. Yeah, that's the other side of it. Yeah, and as I said, I'm focusing more on when you're the person who can see it. But yeah, when you are in that, it's like, I want to help you out. I just can't see the ball. I have no idea.
Yeah. There are kind of two offshoots to this I want to discuss, Dave. First one's rather more basic. It tends to happen in the warm-up when everyone's having all that sort of free-for-all shots on goal from distance phase of the warm-up, which tends to be 90% of the warm-up, let's face it. You've got your back to someone who you can sense is about to kick the ball, and the sheer terror that comes over you and you think you might get hit in the back of the head with the ball, and then it turns out it was nowhere near you or they haven't shot, and it becomes an incredibly embarrassing moment.
Yeah.
And you hope that no one saw it happen.
And you go with such an exaggerated duck or like sidestep or whatever.
Cowering like a little boy.
Yeah.
Or, of course, there's the offshoot of that, Charlie, is where someone boots it up in the end and shouts heads. And then, as far as I'm concerned, that the impending doom of that landing on you never actually happens.
Terrifying. You've got no idea. And you're like, oh, should I move? Should I not move? Whatever I do feels like the wrong thing.
Interesting idea. I've never considered sort of deviating from the cowering option and then actually running in a certain direction as far away as possible. I never thought of doing that. Would it work better? Moving target.
Yeah. You feel like whatever you're going to do, it's putting yourself in more danger.
Hey, look, if you're moving, that's going to be a glancing blow, Dave. That's a better option. Next time it happens, sprint. Off to the side.
Whichever way you're facing, just go. Scramble. Everyone go.
You know, like the advice they give you when you meet a shark in the ocean or something. This is vital information for the public to know. Oh, dear. Right. The more advanced offshoot of this, Charlie. So Tom Atkins has presented a scenario where the ball has ricocheted up into the air and you're looking around for it because you don't know where it's gone. You don't even know it's gone up in the air. But to take the vantage point that you've suggested, you know, from afar, you're trying to help. And I see this on, I experience this when I'm watching televised games at a top level as well. When the ball spins up in the air, like properly spins up, you know that when it bounces, what direction it's going to go in, because you've already, your brain has already worked out the spin. And I see it happening five side, I see it happening left side. And this isn't a boast by any stretch of the imagination, because it's the crappiest ability to have. And I'm sure most people have it. But I'm like, I know where it's going. Go in that direction.
Yeah.
And it's like, but when it's your own team on telly and you know that it's spinning in a good direction, you're like, oh, I'm so happy. Because for that split second while the ball's in the air, you know it's going to be all right, because it's going to spin somewhere innocuous rather than towards your own goal or over someone's head. And it's a great, I don't know, I would call it a fifth and a half sense.
Yeah. I mean, so many of these, like, I think a recurring theme on these fascinations that people send are being in the know, being ITK on the most micro levels. You know, we had the one about like spotting how many minutes were going to be added on, or which sub was going to be made, all of those sorts of things. Yeah, if you know it's going to bounce off for a throw or something like that, it does feel like a superpower.
It's not something you can really, you can't really shout it out in the stands though, can you?
Going off at 11 o'clock. It's going at 11 o'clock. Should start doing that. I think it would befuddle people more. But these kind of elements of micro knowledge that Charlie refers to here, this is just the byproduct of watching football for 30 years. This stuff is going to seep in. You're going to get this expertise. Right. Let's delve into our second fascination from our listeners for April. It comes from Carl White.
I am endlessly fascinated by the concept of a striker shooting over the bar and the co-commentator accusing the striker of leaning back as if it's the only thing that could possibly have caused the shot to go over the bar. It could either like go just like a little bit, it could like graze the bar on the way over, or it could be ballooned into rosette, but the striker is still accused of leaning back. And I'm thinking it's chiefly Alan Smith who's saying this. I feel like it was huge in the 2000s for commentators to say this, and it kind of like didn't happen for a bit. I feel like I just didn't hear it at all, and then I feel like it's just come back with a vengeance this season. Maybe because we've got more defined number nines? I don't know. Interested to hear what you think.
The potted history and sort of A-level style sort of rationale at the end, Charlie, really crowned it for me there.
Yeah, I really like that. That's exactly the sort of kind of time frame.
Add some authority to say, oh, it went away, but it's come back again. I don't know. Yeah. No idea.
The idea that it was huge for a period. I mean, I know exactly what he means.
Yes.
I mean, there's the kind of head over the ball is the sort of the thing that goes hand in hand with this. Again, I think you rarely hear it said, oh, he's done really well, he gets his head over the ball.
No, I think you do.
You do a bit, but I still think it's more the, oh, he needs to get his head over the ball there.
Yeah.
Rather than leaning back.
Dave, this is one of the crown jewels, I would say, of technical reverse engineering when it comes to commentary. Like, this has never been debunked, and perhaps it isn't debunkable, this whole leaning back thing, but commentators love pointing it out. Like, it's real entry-level stuff. Like, it's real sort of any youngsters watching stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think it probably, it does speak to a certain generation. Maybe it is still the first thing that kids get taught. I don't know. But it does feel very like that's the thing I learned in the 60s and 70s in PE. Just the first ever...
First ball, rule of shooting.
First lesson we ever had at shooting was get your head over the ball, don't lean back.
I mean, on a similar level, if you ever see a player sort of casually, absent-mindedly bouncing while they stretch in a warm-up, it's, oh, don't do that. You definitely don't want to do that. You'll cause some serious damage to your muscles if you bounce. Don't bounce. Well, I haven't heard it for years. Maybe it isn't. Yeah. Maybe it has been debunked.
I'm interested here, though, with Carl talks about the idea. He's sort of suggesting that it's wrong, this analysis, which I don't really know. Like, the extent to which you can always explain a shot going over, like, is that always because someone is...
There
ever
are some
so
examples.
Slightly leaning back.
I think there's an element of truth.
It's definitely correct on occasion. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of an example where a player was really leaning back so far that it became a real clear-cut case, and it was almost so obvious. But
they fell over.
The player kicks the ball like that. So.
Whoa! It is a thing you see. I can think of top of my head like two or three examples from my Sunday league season this year where people have missed sitters, and they're like, they are really almost at like a 45 degree angle, and you can see before they've even hit the ball, you go, oh, this is over. Look how far you're leaning back.
Yeah.
Where do you think it stems from? Like, people, why do people do it? Is it trying to get power and then they just get the balance slightly wrong and lean back too far? Because you need to lean back a bit, don't you?
Maybe it's they're so obsessed, Charlie, with being praised for having their head up while they play that they've gone too far. Look at him. He's got his head up. That's what I like about him. He has his head up all the time, even when he shoots. And sometimes that works against him.
He's got a picture.
Was Sterling leaning back for his free kick the other week at Stamford Bridge?
His infamous Chelsea free kick?
Yeah.
Don't know.
Probably.
Do famously hunched over players have a better record at shooting from distance? Julio Arca was quite hunchy, wasn't he? Peter Beardsley? You don't associate these players with shots off target. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Ronaldo's the master of the hunched finish, I think. In fact, the day that we record is I saw an on this day earlier of his goal against Porto, 15th of April. And he's so hunched over the ball for that one where he just drills it in.
Really engaging the abs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you might be right. Maybe that's where it stems from. Poor core strength leading to shots off target. And it did make me think, Charlie, of other sort of casually inserted rationale for off target or failed finishes. Classic one would be, oh, he was off balance. Mm. I mean that's logical. But I really enjoy that. The ball was just stuck under his feet.
Yeah, he couldn't get it out.
It's annoying to see a player with a ball stuck under their feet.
Yeah, it's that touch there. He just needs to get it in front of him.
There.
Okay, Carl, we to an extent, we share your fascination with this one. The final fascination for the listeners for April comes from Tom Walker.
A fascination with football that I realised in the Luton Forest game was in the home end behind the goal, in the corner on the big screen, there's a clock that ticks down to the second, which I'm not sure many Premier League grounds or any grounds have, really. It seems quite rare. But watching that time perfectly with the broadcast clock on the score, it was very satisfying. But annoyingly, at the other end where the away fans were, there is also a big clock on a big screen directly above the goal, and that one seemed to be a second off. So I really enjoyed it at one end, and the other end was a massive irritation.
Dave, he has presented a scenario here, Tom Walker. Any relation?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. he's presented a scenario here that I've never seen, because I'm a keen subconscious noticer of physical clocks matching up to TV clocks, and they never do. And he suggested that one at Kenilworth Road, I believe, it does happen. Magic, if so, because there should be a delay on the broadcast, shouldn't there? So Ofcom should be involved, if anything.
But you're right in that the non-broadcast thing, the non-sync comes from the fact that broadcasts are normally a little bit delayed.
Yeah, a couple of seconds behind.
Yeah.
So but if it matches up, then something's gone very wrong.
Is he talking about a countdown as well? Or is he, because that's what some grounds do, which is quite rogue. Or is he just, he's just talking about a normal clock?
Do they?
Going up. Do you know, some
which
have a really confusing...
Which grounds do a countdown?
Some have done it, and some, really? Maybe not anymore, but there definitely used to be a thing where grounds would do that. Maybe they've all got rid of it because it was quite confusing.
If I saw a countdown clock, Dave, my brain would not subconsciously care, because I would never subconsciously do the maths of whether it's adding up to a full minute of one counting down and my TV one counting up. So if anything, that would solve my... mild obsession. But there is an offshoot of this, Dave. When at a certain angle, it's usually when a pitch side cameraman is taking sort of footage of a player taking a throw-in on a close-up, you'll see the big screen behind them also with the footage of them taking a throw-in. And of course, it is about a second and a half behind. And then, of course, behind them on that screen, the footage is even further behind.
Yeah.
Oh, God!
Just an infinite vortex.
Yeah. Whenever, Charlie, I see a big screen footage on the screen, it blows my mind, because you just think, wow, they don't know. They don't know what's going to happen. I've watched too much football. It's a fact.
But in his example, there's another clock that doesn't sync. So what's going on there?
I know. That's poor. I mean, that's what you get at a Tim Pot Stadium like that. They didn't spend their, you know, reconstruction money well.
Two separate clockmen who have to operate their clocks. They've not synchronised.
One's still championship level. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of part one. We'll be back very shortly with your irritations.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Football Clichés. We've heard your fascinations for April. Now it's time to get stuck into your irritations. The first one, these are very niche, comes from Warren Heyman.
My ongoing concern with the modern game is the AstroTurf obsession behind the goal line leading up to the net, the netting. So there were some wonderful goals, like Aston Villa, where they have grass, the same colour grass as on the main pitch, goes behind the goal line all the way up to the netting, and it's as you were for many years ago. But creeping into the game is this obsession with having AstroTurf within 1 yard or 1 foot of the goal line. So as immediately as the goal line has ended, you're into AstroTurf. And it's sometimes of a different colour to the grass. Some teams do it maybe 3 or 4 yards back. So you've got half grass, half astro before the netting. It's all of a different colour. It looks like a complete mishmash. For me, grass is integral to football pitches and it should remain on both sides of the touchline, including the goal line. Most importantly, the goal line. Thank you.
By way of an addendum, I would say that the part between the goal line and the netting is the least used part of any football pitch. I accept it's actually not part of the pitch because it's out of play. But if you running with what I say, this therefore is used the least. Therefore, this is the section of the pitch that need not be astro. It in fact could be grass, because if it's for maintenance, it needn't be maintained as much as other parts of the grass which are used as the full pitch in itself. It's all back to front.
Oh, Warren, mate. That was 2 minutes, the original clip that he sent through. Charlie, do you sympathise, do you chime with any of this?
To the point where I'm now sort of Googling Villa Park to try and get a sense of what it is he's talking about. It's certainly not something I can remember that I've ever particularly been bothered by. That said, looking at an image of Villa Park, does look nice.
All grass, is it?
Yeah, it is. And that does look really nice. I'm trying to look at...
So does the AstroTurf stop before the post and then continue again after the other post?
At Villa Park, it goes
Villa
on...
Villa Park's all grass, isn't it? That's what
yeah,
that's point that's
the point. Oh, so there's no AstroTurf at Villa Park?
Doesn't look like it.
Wow.
Until you get... I mean, you've then got that
little...
Do you
wait for know about this?
They've got that little strip, then the grass goes either quite a few yards behind the goal, and then you've got a strip. But I'm trying to see.
Oh, they've got the sort of clarity strip. Yeah. Okay. Oh, interesting. That's bold, Dave. I mean, I'm all right with AstroTurf down the sides of every other pitch in the Premier League because they get used a lot. There's linos running up and down them. You've got broadcasting teams. They're going to get cut up, and that's bad for the product, right? It's bad for the Premier League product visually.
I don't think I've necessarily noticed this. So he's saying that there are some grounds that AstroTurf goes right up to the pitch. All the way around.
Right to the very top.
Right to the very top. He's saying that it's, you know, aesthetically unpleasing that just after the goal line, barely after a yard or two, the AstroTurf begins and it should be fully grassed, the goal mouth. And I have to say, I completely agree, because it's kind of an honorary part of the pitch, isn't it? It's not technically part of the playable surface of a pitch, but that stuff happens in a goal mouth. Drama happens. And, you know, pantomime stuff happens as well. It's a very active part of the pitch. It should be treated with respect.
Hang on a minute. You're calling the goal mouth a bit in the goal, behind the line.
Have I got that wrong? I have, haven't I?
That's not the goal mouth, is it? I mean, I suppose if you...
I think it is.
But you...
In the goal mouth. He's ended up in the goal mouth.
Charlie?
No. What is the Goldmouth? Goldmouth. Mm. Oh, of course. Do you remember? Who remembers?
Greater Goldmouth.
Goldmouth is the 6-yard box. You know,
yeah, fine. Yeah, of course it is. Okay, but yeah.
Think about it. It sort of works.
Back of the net. That old phrase. That's what I'm aiming for. It should be grassed, shouldn't it? As Warren points out, Charlie, what need is there to be AstroTurf in the back of a goal?
I'm with him.
Yeah.
It's just not something I've ever really noticed or felt strongly about.
It's amazing. So Villa, like Leighton Orient with the stanchions, do you reckon they're the last outliers when it comes to AstroTurf goals?
I think Chelsea, just looking at it, they look like they have that AstroTurf all over, it looks like. And yeah, it's not as aesthetically pleasing.
I remember Anfield, Charlie. If you think back to the Newcastle 4-3 games era, I don't know if it's still the same now, but the back of their nets were absolutely horrendous because that's where the camber had already begun. And the nets, players would end up down the hill, tied up in the net as well. It was awful to watch.
Those nets were terrible, yeah.
Yeah. I think Robbie Fowler sort of famously celebrated by just sliding into it and just being enveloped by the whole thing. Horrible to watch. But yeah, Warren Heyman, just glad you got it off your chest, quite frankly. And if there's anyone out there who sympathises with this, I hope you form some sort of association or club. Next irritation from our listeners for April comes from Luke Martin.
Hi guys, forgive my voice. I was at a wedding last night and I'm a bit worse for wear. My football irritation is when teams from the same leagues play each other in European competition. If I wanted to watch Liverpool play Chelsea, I would watch the Barclays on a Sunday. If I wanted to watch the Milan Derby, I would watch whatever James Richardson was hosting. The worst version of this is when the teams also play each other in the domestic cup in the same week. Fuck off. Nobody likes it. Get it in the bin.
Charlie, I imagine this is probably, hangover inspired, this gripe, and perhaps he's expressed too much vitriol for it. But fundamentally, are, let's specifically say, all England European ties, are they a kind of a wasted opportunity for the spectacle? I mean, is he right along those lines? Like, we see them in other competitions. Does it waste, the potential drama?
I was having this conversation actually with someone recently, and I was sort of saying, wondering why, in a way, UEFA doesn't, like, who benefits from having country versus country? Like, who would be disappointed if you couldn't have quarterfinals between two teams from the same country? I don't really imagine anyone would be, would they? Apart from, I guess, if we think the Premier League is stronger, would there be non-Premier League teams who'd be annoyed about that because they'd be like, no, you can't fiddle with the draw, let them play each other and knock each other out. Yeah. I guess they would be, but
broadcasters would be unhappy. You get a bigger audience for a Liverpool Man City quarterfinal, semi-final than you would do if it was Man City against Real Madrid. Might be an exception, but if it was against Sporting.
Sure. So from fans' point of view, though, I can't imagine many fans. Let's say with the Champions League draw as it is, how many fans are going to be like, oh, yes, we get Arsenal City? Everyone surely would much prefer that those two teams, if they go through, are kept apart. I mean, I guess there's a slight curiosity.
I think it's a coin toss, really. I'm not sure.
Really?
Yeah.
I think everyone, if the last four teams...
You want the mystique, do you? That's what you want.
I think if the last four teams in the tournament are Barcelona, Atletico Madrid, Arsenal and City, I think the vast majority of fans want English v Spanish and English v Spanish.
But if you put them together in the semis, then you're guaranteed a final that doesn't have them together. So are you playing the longer game or not?
True, but I think there's something about this two legs of it is quite painful, especially, like Luke says, if they have recently played each other in the league or in a cup competition.
Yes, that's true.
And there definitely is also the hangover from that Liverpool-Chelsea shit-on-a-stick rivalry, as whoever it was. Was it Florentino Perez who called it that?
But they also had some great games in the same era. They had some incredible encounters.
They did have some good ones. Yeah, they had that amazing 4-4 one, didn't they?
Yeah.
The Fabio Aurelio free kick.
There's more beef. There's like more potential ongoing drama, isn't there? Little subplots. Whereas, with a completely not unknown entity, but with a kind of slightly less familiar opponent, you might not have that kind of narrative oomph to it. Or do you even need it?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you can have too much. Like, it can become too sort of needly and that can overtake everything.
So you think it's unimaginative, basically?
I just think you want the novelty. You want to play European team. You dream of playing against the European big boys rather than a kind of like, oh, great, we get to play, Manchester United twice in the space of a week.
You do. On paper, I think this argument stacks up, because yeah, you want the draw. You want, after the draw, you want to be excited about a combination that maybe you haven't seen for a while or whatever, and it's between two great European teams. Yeah, but as you say, Adam, if you look back at the last almost 20 years, let's say, so many great games in the Champions League between two English teams, Chelsea and Liverpool, even like the Arsenal-Chelsea quarterfinal, in City and Liverpool, City and Spurs in the quarterfinal,
yeah,
in a few years ago. Like, and I think that's because, you know, it goes in sort of waves, doesn't it? But a lot of those periods, the English teams have been the best teams in Europe. So you want to see the best teams playing each other, because it should result in some of the best games.
And I don't know, if you look back at them on a surface level, Charlie, all those games we've cited as being great games between two English clubs in Europe, were they great because they were two English clubs playing each other? You could argue it probably wasn't. Like, it was just incidental drama, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so. I think, like, in a spur, like Spurs City was just too... It was a really good clash, and they were both pretty exciting, watchable teams at that time, and it kind of made for chaos.
You did get odd little quirks of the spectacle when two English clubs play each other, Dave, which is obviously, they, you know, they're playing to European rules, so there's no high feet. They've got to change the way they're playing. And this argument that they should have an English referee if it's going to be two English teams. Should be like a Premier League game.
Yeah, I actually prefer them meeting over two legs in a quarter or semi-final than them meeting in the final.
Yes.
I prefer a final to be like a classic matchup.
100%.
Also, that's more novelty, isn't it? Because a two-leg, you've still got like, oh, they're playing two legs, and there used to be away goals, which felt like it differentiated it enough. Whereas, two really good English teams playing each other in a final, you're like, this could be the FA Cup final. Or
yeah.
And it's something about having been at the 2019 Champions League final, the fact that both Spurs and Liverpool sort of took over separate parts of Madrid, just, I didn't like it, because it's in a neutral venue. You've got two English clubs both going to the same place. I prefer there to be, I don't know, I just, there's a different atmosphere if it's one English team or one British team and against a team from Spain or Germany or Italy or whatever. And equally, when Atletico had Real Madrid in the Champions League final, I wonder how that goes down, in how that's viewed by the sort of Madrid fans and the Madrid press. But I found it harder to get excited about.
I certainly don't, if it's an all English final, Charlie, I certainly don't sit there thinking, God, what strength the English game has. I'm so glad that we're dominating at the top table of European football. It's very far from my concerns, I would say. And another stakeholder, I would argue, Charlie, that may not want clubs from the same country playing each other is perhaps the producers of Champions League weekly or preview programming, who rely on that little bit extra level of mystique when it comes to player interviews and saying, well, we know they are a strong team, but they are a challenge, but we are also a good team as well. You can't really have that with two teams who are so familiar with each other. But then I suppose you can go the other way. So, well, we know each other very well, and they are.
We know our strength. We know their strengths so well. You mentioned, Adam, about the having a referee from the same country and stuff. The discourse now is at a point. Fletch was saying, and I'm sure many would have agreed with this, something like, it's going to be fascinating tonight seeing how the English refs do VAR, because, you know, it's so much quicker in the Champions League. And sort of that's where we're at now, that it's not just the English teams that we're watching with so much interest. It's how, you know, how will the referee and his VAR team operate in a different environment? They're not at Stockley Park anymore, of course.
Yeah, can they adjust to the wilier circumstances?
Exactly.
Are they as streetwise as their European counterparts? Yeah, excellent work. Right, let's have our third and final irritation from our listeners, and it comes from Dan Atwood. It really gives me the ick, he says, when a team concedes and their manager or their coaches immediately go back to their seat to watch a replay of the goal they've just let in on an iPad. Like, are they really watching for tactical reasons? I really don't think they are, as they normally sit in silence. Or is it just an awkward reaction where they feel the need to get behind a screen for some reason? Charlie, do you think it is a posturing thing? Or do you think they are so dedicated to analysing each moment? Or is it a bit of both?
Or is there a VAR element of a kind of like, is this going to get disallowed? Is there something we can start screaming about? I mean, it wasn't a goal, but Ten Hag, after the late penalty given against United on Saturday, he was instantly down watching it on the iPad.
So you think you don't see it for sort of straightforward, inarguable, no wrinkles kind of goals?
No, you probably would as well. But but bearing in mind most goals, there could be something in the background. And yeah, there might be an element of kind of, yeah, let's instantly see what we can address here tactically. I agree that it does feel there is something that feels a bit wrong. I remember so vividly the first time I ever saw a manager
right.
doing this. It was just before Jose Mourinho was sacked for the first time in 2007 by Chelsea.
Okay.
It was a home game against Blackburn, I think, and Chelsea had a goal disallowed. And he was able to see it. So he went mad at the ref and had been able to... I think he'd seen it before probably he went and approached the ref or saw it after approaching the ref. But it was the first... And it felt really wrong and weird. It was like, but you're not allowed to... You can't see that in real time in the same way that...
So this was what, late 2007?
September 2007. I think okay, it was
iPad
like...
iPad wasn't released until April 2010. That's all I'm saying.
No, not an iPad. It was right. on a... Like he saw it on a screen.
Massive desktop computer.
He went... No, it must have been on a TV or something.
Right, yeah.
He sort of nipped back and saw it and then carried on his berating. And he was sacked a few days later.
Dave, maybe this is like the latest twist in a... as we've established, a fairly modern phenomenon of managers trying to look cool after their team has conceded, like they've still got it under control, that there's no drama here, we've just conceded. And maybe it's kind of a show of weakness if you sort of sit back in your chair sort of Allardyce style and go and show you're really gutted by a goal.
I think, to be honest, I don't think it probably isn't as cool and sort of collected as that. I think if we were to mic the managers up, and you could see it in one of the documentaries or something, that it would be more akin to Graham Taylor in the Impossible Job documentary, just looking for someone to blame and to pinpoint where it went wrong. You know, when he's like, what a ball, Des to Barnsley. I mean, if Taylor had a monitor back then, he would have had a field day. But it'll be a manager going to, oh, it's Robbo, fucking Robbo, he's out. I told you. It's just, they're just looking for someone to blame, I think.
What do you do when Ribblesdale Rovers concede on the touchline? Straight over to your mobile.
I do often have a little chat with like whoever's the subs, or if there's someone on the touchline with me. We will kind of, depends how bad of an error it was. Sometimes at Sunday League level, you don't even, you know, it's just obvious.
Somebody's just missed a header,
high ball or something. But I'm generally quite encouraging.
Charlie, what would you say is the classic example of a goal these days that would cause a manager to go and consult an iPad, VAR issues aside?
I think if their team's been sort of cut apart,
right,
so it looks like a player has switched off or there's a kind of structural issue. But yeah, I'm imagining a kind of through ball to a fullback who's bizarrely free, who then crosses it low, and a player has a kind of a tap in, and it's like, How did they get in so easily?
Yes.
What about our structures have broken down here? I'm going to look really earnestly. I picture Gary O'Neill doing it quite a lot in tracksuit.
Yeah, who is the most consultant iPad kind of manager?
Yeah, I think of him very earnestly, very seriously, furrowed brow, looking at it.
Pep is obviously the godfather of this, surely.
Pep often goes back and has a chat with the, who's the guy? Juan Marlillo?
Kevin Keegan lookalike, yeah.
Kevin Keegan, yeah. every time he gets me.
Barbecue this weekend?
Yeah.
And I think this will be this conversation between the manager and assistant or analyst or whatever will be ripe for like the football lingo in speak that we sometimes hear. It'll be like, oh yeah, tails. He's lost a second there. He loses the second in the middle. Like these little words, the coach words or whatever that we wouldn't look for.
The body language of this little exchange, Charlie, especially between Pep and Juan Marlillo, is very distinct. They're the two roles, because the manager does essentially the bemoaning of what's happened. And then the assistant manager's, his job is to sit there and sort of be a bit more philosophical about it and go, God.
Yeah, I was just getting, there's a shrug, isn't there?
Like, what can we do? But you don't want to go overtly, what can we do? Because then it implies that you don't know what to do. So it's got a bit like, these things happen. It's kind of a shrug, isn't it? It's like, what can we tell them? You know, we told them time and time again. That's kind of the shrug, isn't it?
You want to let them just keep venting.
But then... this wouldn't happen with Pep, because I don't think Juan Marlillo ever gets into the technical area. But I can see with some assistants, maybe, I don't know, Ray Lewington with Roy Hodgson or Jason Tindall with Eddie Howe, they'd kind of just get up midway through the manager ranting, just kind of leave them to it, and then go and just do a bit of encouraging themselves.
Yeah.
Grabbing the bull by the horns.
Weirdly, though, Charlie, I mean, we've talked, most of the sort of scenario that we've been talking about here is a goal conceded. You don't see it happen very often for goals scored. If anything, you think it'd be more likely to happen. I mean, obviously, there's an outburst of emotion, but if anything, managers play it cool for goals they've just scored as well. So why are they not sort of applying the looking at an iPad aspect of the of the kind of goal celebration, if you like.
I bet some do, we just haven't noticed, or it's not shown for whatever reason. Because, yeah, also there's a kind of Pep ostentatious quality to that of like, we've scored and I'm still not satisfied. So, you know, the manager was so analytical that even after a goal, he wasn't happy.
Picking
he was just working out how he'd improve.
We've tried to score the perfect goal there.
Yeah, it's like when managers like are ostentatiously angry after scoring. Mm. Mourinho used to be great at that. Yeah. Just be like, I don't care we've scored, I'm still not happy.
There was an example recently, I can't remember which match it was, but there was where a manager turned round and sort of gave the nod to the set-piece coach.
Yeah.
And I think
Postecoglou's done that.
Yeah.
I think he did that after at Old Trafford earlier this season.
That's a nice kind of touch. Like, I'm all good for one. That. Yeah. I asked Charlie a minute ago, Dave, what sort of goal you think classically lends itself to iPad post-analysis after you've conceded? What kind of goal do you think least lends itself? And I imagine if you just considered an absolute, you know, open and shut case of a 35-yard screamer into the top corner and going back to watch it on the iPad and going, whoa, sort of waggling your wrist like, going, oh, decent goal, actually. What a hit. Nothing you could have done.
Goal.
Looking back at the goalkeeper goes, no, two goalkeepers wouldn't have said that. I've just confirmed it.
Yeah, maybe even the goals that Tottenham conceded at the weekend to Newcastle. You know, just a long ball over the top and then Van de Ven just falls over. Yeah. Like, there's not a great deal of analysis you can do for that, is there?
No. If anything, you're just being a bit more voyeuristic if you're looking at that unfold again, Charlie, because like, they look like you're really sort of taking the mick out of the guy who literally fell over. That would rub salt in the wound, I sense.
Yeah, if you've just scored the goal, you're like, oh, I've got to see this again. This blooper after an own goal.
He's got an arse over tit.
Just rewind that bit again.
Can you rewind it? I don't know. It depends if it's on TNT or on Sky Go, I guess. It's a difficult one. Anyway, well, a lovely little flourish there from Dan Atwood. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. Well done to you, Charlie Eccleshare.
Thank you.
And well entertained, Dave Walker. From the weirdness from our listeners.
There's no question that that was the weirdest we've had so far.
Still clinging on to relevance, though. I don't think we've gone off the rails too far with that one. Keep them coming, that's what I think. Thanks, everyone, for sending them in. We've saved a few as well, so your chance may still come. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back on Tuesday. See ya.